Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. In just a few days, we'll find out whether Barack Obama or Mitt Romney will be leading the world's most powerful country for the next 4 years. While Americans are eager to leave the grueling political season behind, Africans, Asians, and Europeans are eager to hear the first hints about their biggest concern, foreign policy. They certainly didn't hear much during the campaign. The economy is driving, and foreign policy concerns are in the back seat, or more accurately, on the side of the road. But the world seems to be getting more volatile, and the United States cannot afford to stay disengaged from international disputes. Joining us in the Global Journalist Studio to provide that wider perspective is Joseph Odindo, editorial director of the largest independent media conglomerate in East and Central Africa. The Nation Media Group includes 10 newspapers, 2 television stations, 3 radio stations, and websites in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. On the phone from Washington is Chidu Rajgata, foreign editor and U.S. correspondent of the Times of India. The newspaper is the world's largest broadsheet English daily, with a circulation of 2.5 million. Joseph, we're glad to have you here in the studio, and Chidu, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Chidu, you wrote an article recently that cited a national survey of Asian Americans and Indian Americans, and it shows that Indian Americans are by far the largest supporters of Obama among that group, 68% to 5%, with the rest undecided, with Romney getting the 5%. Now, what are a few of the reasons for that popularity of Obama?
Well, there's a backdrop to this to the survey and to the general, pro-Obama sentiment. One is that Indians, first of all, there's a huge uptick in U.S.-India relations. And this goes across administrations, both in India and in the U.S. It just doesn't seem to matter whether it's a Democratic dispensation or a Republican administration here. And similarly, in India, it doesn't matter if it's the sort of centrist Congress party or the right-wing BJP. There is an overall uptick in U.S.-India relations that's now almost 20 years old, ever since the Cold War got over and all the ideological boundaries were brought down. These two countries have enjoyed enormously good relations in the last two decades, probably better than almost any other country in a world where the U.S. seems to be constantly firefighting. And then to come to the Indian American population here, this is a group which has done incredibly well in the U.S. India sends a large number of skilled professionals. They are what we call the creamy layer, the elites of India who migrate to the U.S. And typically, immigrants tend to be democratic when they come in. Indian Americans have done well professionally. They've climbed up the social ladder here. Economically, they are very well off. They're one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest subgroup. And there's been some talk that as people become more wealthy, they tend to trend towards Republican, they have Republican tendencies. It's worked only to a certain extent with Indian Americans. They still seem largely democratic, and I think President Obama, is benefiting from that. And then, of course, there is the aspirational angle to it. The fact is, a lot of people see in Obama a reflection of themselves.
Right.
He's not just American, he's African American. In fact, he's not even just African American, he's Asian African American. A lot of people see, certain Asian qualities.
Right. And also, And Joseph, he's also, of course, very popular in Africa for more obvious reasons, since his father's from Kenya.
Yeah, David, you're right about that. I think for most Africans, is the last point that Chi mentioned, that many Africans see in Obama. They see themselves. No, they see themselves.
Yes.
Yeah, he represents. It's the kinship more than the values he stands for. In fact, it's ironical that the position he's taken on certain issues like gay rights and the rest would make it very difficult to him to win an African presidency in some of the African countries with large Christian populations.
Right.
Yeah. But then in the American elections, there's a subjective preference for him. And there's also the expectation, especially in countries which are going through political transition, that he will be more sympathetic, mm-hmm. partly because of his ancestry and partly because he's a Democrat, that he'll be more sympathetic and will support the more popular causes. I mean, the transition will side with the majority of the people and just possibly stand for the progressive politics.
And what are some of the things, what's at stake in Africa with regards to foreign policy?
It's difficult to generalize with Africa as a whole. Because the different regions, there are different issues. In Eastern Africa, for instance, it's the whole thing of terrorism is a big issue. And America's attitude towards the region's the security issue in Eastern Africa is something that's important to the people. In Kenya, it's political change. They're implementing political reforms. I would say actually the issues in Uganda and Kenya and Rwanda, it's all about political reforms. Yeah, will America push for a more democratic dispensation? Will they support the forces which are more inclusive in their politics? The expectation would have been really that I think that by his record, Obama has done very well so far. Yeah, and the reason they would want him to continue is that so that this pressure for these changes is sustained.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now we spoke a few days ago with the White House correspondent for the French news agency, AFP, Steve Collinson, pointed out that 4 years ago, Obama's foreign policy was largely aspirational. But the realities of international relations, with each country acting in its own best interest, thwarted some of those goals. And Collinson also talked about some of the biggest disputes that are now facing the world.
The U.S. position in the Middle East is eroding, as we saw from the attack on the consulate in Benghazi. There are massive issues to be resolved about how the West is going to stop the spread of violence from Syria. The U.S. relationship with China is very delicate. There's a power transition going on in China this year, as well as in the United States, to a new generation of leaders. So there are lots of pressing, urgent, very important foreign policy issues, which I think the next president will have to deal with. If it's President Obama, I think he will pivot fairly quickly. He has a couple of domestic initiatives, but immigration reform, for example. But he's going to, as I understand it, be very, very keen to re-engage on the world stage. He's also, you know, at that point, he'll be also looking to his foreign policy legacy as much as anything else. If we have a President Romney, it's going to be a case of, you know, the first 100 days getting his domestic legislation through, repealing Obamacare, but he will also face very important foreign policy decisions. And for him, it'll be a case of framing exactly what his foreign policy is going to be and introducing himself to the world. So, this year has by necessity been very taken up with domestic politics and the business of elections, but I think next year the United States cannot afford not to re-engage at the highest level as the president with the rest of the world.
And during the presidential debate that focused on foreign policy, the moderator asked both Obama and Romney what they consider to be the biggest security threat. Obama said terrorism. And Romney said Iran and the concern about the nuclear weapons capability. So, and Collinson also spoke about what he also sees as the, what he sees as the biggest security threat, which is Pakistan.
And just on Pakistan, I mean, Pakistan is another huge issue for the next U.S. president, which I've not touched on yet. I mean, Pakistan has 90-odd nuclear weapons. It's a very dangerous, it's a very unstable state. You know, there's a lot of concern about what would happen if the current civilian government, which is allied to the military, were to get taken over by a more extreme Islamic element. So, or even if the state kind of became a failed state, what would happen with a nuclear weapon? So that, if you talk to U.S. officials, you know, privately, they often, you say to them, what's the biggest threat the United States faces? They will often talk privately, not publicly, but say, you know, Pakistan is a huge, we always kind of fall asleep worrying about Pakistan. So that's a massive national security threat that the next president will face too.
And Chidu, would you agree that from India's perspective, that Pakistan may be the biggest security threat for the world?
Oh, absolutely. I think Constance is dead right. And, you know, it's not just from India's perspective. It's the regional perspective. It's a, you know, it's a world perspective. Constance is right that U.S. administrators are loath to talk about this publicly. And, you know, the U.S. talks about, you know, the usual roster of, you know, suspect states or rogue, so-called rogue states, Venezuela and Cuba. And these are not the real dangerous states. The real dangerous state is Pakistan, which is 180 million people, nuclear weapons, and a deeply, deeply, you know, divided and increasingly radicalized society. You know, the big story today out of Pakistan is how there were mobs which attacked a girls' school and, you know, ransacked and burnt the school down because somebody said, you know, somebody in the school had blasphemed. And if you look at the pictures coming out of this story, it's an all-male crowd, and it's frightening. This country has gone completely radical. The liberal elements are on the run. They're marginalized, and they have nuclear weapons. And the first country, you know, in the line of fire for, you know, against Pakistan is actually India. So, yes, the Indians would be deeply concerned about Pakistan and the U.S. policy on Pakistan. And both presidential candidates have been sort of, you know, under the radar about it. They don't like to talk about Pakistan publicly. But you're right, and Collinson's right, that this is the number one danger in the world. And this is not new. I mean, going back into, you know, the previous Bush administration and going back to even Clinton administration, the former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, actually said Pakistan would be the world's biggest headache. And that's proved to be correct.
And what do most of the people in India think about the drone war, the use of drones? It's becoming more controversial, and it seems to be killing a large number of civilians in the process. Do you think that's a good tactic?
Nobody has ever, you know, proved to me or produced proof that, you know, large number of civilians are being killed. And I keep looking for pictures. Where are the pictures of civilians being killed or children being killed? Where are the photos? Where is the journalism about this? So we don't know about that. Look, any time, you know, a population is being bombed, it's unfortunate. And I wish the U.S. was more clear, more public, more open about who they are bombing, where they are bombing, why they are bombing, what is the, you know, evidence, the rationale. The U.S. has also been very sort of quiet, or they've not really been clear about what's happening. But the fact of the matter is, I think the Indians will just be happy as long as, you know, the whole conflagration is contained within Pakistan. The last thing the Indians want is for the U.S., you know, to pull out or to stop, and the so-called, you know, crazed, you know, jihadis or fundamentalists to be at the doors of Kashmir. For the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, Kashmir has been relatively quiet It's on the back burner, and peace has returned. There are a lot of tourists who are now going into Kashmir. And the Indians don't want, the jihadi flock to turn their attention to Kashmir like they did in the late 80s. So what happened in the late 80s was once the Soviet Union pulled out of Afghanistan, a lot of these freelance mujahideen, had plenty of weapons and nothing to do, so they turned their attention to Kashmir, and Kashmir went up in flames. So that's something the Indians would be very conscious of. So they'd want this war against terrorism contained within the AFPAC region and won. In that sense, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, there's been a degree of continuity about how they have handled this region, and that includes drone wars. And to be honest, I don't see any evidence for or against this whole drone campaign. Okay. I'm sure there are some collateral damage and there must be civilians dying, but the idea that somehow there are lots and lots of civilians dying, that hasn't been borne out by any kind of journalism out of that region.
Okay, thanks. And Joseph, moving over to Africa, your country is the continent there is facing a lot of conflicts with Islamic militants. What are the biggest security concerns in your in African continent?
Well, depending on which region you're talking about. There is a part of Africa that is grappling with a security issue which revolves around terrorism and Islamic extremism. Then there is a part of Africa that is grappling with the security issues arising from their own internal conflicts, the transitions, the attempts to rearrange their politics. That's what's happening in Central Africa. Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, the attempt to rearrange the internal self-government mechanisms. Now, of course, the Obama government has been engaging with this is very much colors the attitude of especially the middle class and the literati towards this government. But one thing I would say that on the bigger issues of that concern each country, there hasn't been much difference between what George Bush did and what Obama has done. There's been a continuity. I would say that both had a muscular, interventionist policy and quite sensitive to the interests, the progressive interests in each country.
Right.
Obama has continued this more discreetly, you'd say, not as not overtly aggressive as Bush, but the results were the same and the attitude was the same.
Right. What's a good example of this intervention that's under the radar?
A good example really is, you'd say, what, Somalia?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Somalia. Both tried to sort out this problem. The difference is that under the Bush administration, there has been an attempt to be cleverer about it after what happened to Bill Clinton and the Black Hawk. Black Hawk Down incident. And, you've seen the results. They have tried to use the countries which have a better understanding of Somalia, the countries that border Somalia. They have tried to use the people who have a stake in Somalia. And they have provided the support rather than go in and be seen as, Big Brother America is sorting it out. Yeah. Now, this approach has worked very well. I mean, Kenya, for the first time, had a military intervention, was involved in a military intervention, something they've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because Kenya has the largest Somali population outside Somalia.
And that was effective?
It was very effective because their approach was, they have a better understanding of the internal politics, the cultural attitudes of the Somali people. Now, in fact, what the Kenyan forces achieved, the approach was very different from the AMISOM African troops. Yeah, although they eventually converged, but the result has just been incredible for But there's the American hand behind it all. The willingness to support, the sacrifice, the advice they were getting in the background. We all know that there was consistent support. That helped a great deal. The other thing, of course, is whether or not the Obama administration has helped to strengthen the progressive forces in the domestic politics of, African countries. Mm-hmm. I think that has been quite clear. In Kenya, there was a continuity in pushing for reforms, which the George Bush administration had started when there was the outbreak of violence after the elections. The Bush administration was very clear that we will not let Kenya go and that you guys have to sort out your internal politics. And they took a very firm stand, which was very helpful because it was very much in sync with what the majority of the population was feeling. Happily, the Obama administration continued this. Right. And here we are now implementing reforms. We have a new constitution. There has been a radical transformation of the political structures. And this with a lot of the support of the Obama administration. Of course, there has been differences with the Christian right in Kenya because this constitution does offer certain progressive provisions, which, which the Christian right does not support. Which is why I said earlier that, ironically, if Obama stood for elections in Kenya, he would have a lot of difficulty with the larger population, Christian population. But when he's, as long as he's contesting in America.
Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week, we have an interactive map. And we have much other, and we have also the rest of the interview we had with Steve Collinson from AFP. Please send us questions or comments via Global Journalist at KBIA or our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at Global Jorn. Now, Chidu, in the foreign policy debate, neither candidate or even the moderator brought up. What's going on in India or Africa? Was that understandable to you, or do you think that there needs to be some discussion about bilateral relations with India?
Oh, that was totally understandable, at least to me. A Mexican general or revolutionary, I believe, is quoted as saying Mexico is so close to the United States and so far from God. So I'm not sure being mentioned by the U.S. or by U.S. presidential candidates is a mark of some kind of recognition or respect. Most countries which found – in fact, there was a story, and I wrote a piece about this too. Somebody did a sort of head count of how many – which countries found maximum attention. And there was, I think, China, which was mentioned 32 times, and Pakistan 28 times, and Iran some 40 times or whatever. And most of these countries, are crisis-stricken countries, and all the mentions were in a very negative context. So I think the Indians were very relieved that they didn't find any mention. I also need to point out, in the debate itself, both candidates kept dragging, the subject back to domestic politics and domestic economy. But the fact is, the U.S. economy is inextricably linked to foreign policy in many ways. So, I mean, global trade and commerce, is a part of the whole foreign policy beat. And what happens in the U.S. on the economic front deeply affects the world. I mean, look at this hurricane, for instance. I mean, Sandy. 2 days of New York shut down, and the whole global markets went cold. The effects of Sandy were felt in my hometown in India, in Bangalore, where a lot of firms have U.S. operations, had to put it on ice for a while. So what happens, I mean, the U.S. economy, moves world economy in many ways. And then what happens in the U.S. is very, very relevant to the world. I'm actually working on a story for this weekend on this. And, there are about 50 countries which have gone to, which have gone or are going into elections in 2012. And in this month alone, there are half a dozen countries which are having elections. But no country has no country's election has the kind of draws the kind of attention and coverage that the U.S. election does across the world. I mean, we probably carried one or two stories on the elections in let's say Venezuela, which just finished its election. But U.S. election, there are a couple of stories every day. So there's a huge amount of attention, not just U.S. elections, the U.S. economy. For all the talk of decline of U.S. and so on, I think it's in many ways overstated. This still remains the most important country in the world, both in terms of politics and economy.
Would you, Joseph? Would you? What are your? What's your position on whether America is in a decline as far as it's being a world power?
I don't think it's America is in decline. I mean, especially in judging by its interface with Africa, I don't think it is in decline. I think we have seen in Africa we have seen very significant evidence of its superiority as a world power. I think this power is being used more thoughtfully than in the past. I don't know, Americans may view that, may see from their own internal view that perhaps it's in decline. Maybe because the arrogance is not there anymore. Yeah, there's a more considerate approach to how it relates to the rest of the world. There's a greater effort to be fairer to the rest of the world. You sense that, yeah? But the impact it has because of its military might and it's because of its economic might, I don't think it's diminished in any way. We've seen it. We've seen what happened in Libya. Yeah, we've seen, as I said, we've seen what happened in Somalia. We are seeing right now what's happening in Central Africa. And the American hand is there. We are all aware of that.
Well, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today were Chidu Rai Chatta of the Times of India, and here in the studio, Joseph Odindo. I wanted to thank you both for joining us on the show today. It's been very insightful. And Chidu, I hope things go well for you in India, and I'll be looking forward to reading some of your posts from there.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good to be with you.
All right. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. The program is directed by Travis McMillan. Audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. An Chi Du was our lead producer. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch. Join us next week for another Global Journalist.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalists, where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Giselle Sharon. Today's news comes from CNN, BBC World News, and The Guardian. The Bahrain's Information Affairs Authority is defending its ban on all public protests, citing that the restriction is designed to curb violence. The police force said 91 injuries occurred from early May to late July during these protests. The country has averaged one licensed protest per day since the beginning of the year. Somali poet Warsam Shere Awel was shot near his home October 29th. Awel published his art using radio, writing, and acting for more than 30 years. Most of his work criticized the militant group Al-Shabaab, who has battled for Somali government control since the ouster of President Siad Barre in 1991. Al-Shabaab claims responsibility for killing more than 10 journalists this year. Investigative journalist Kostas Vaxivanis is facing charges of breaching Greek privacy laws. He published a list of more than 2,000 wealthy Greeks who had $1.95 billion in deposits in Swiss bank accounts and who are possibly involved in tax evasion. Vaxivanis wrote that the Greek media failed to report the Greek financial scandals uncovered by Reuters and British press. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Giselle Sharon.